month. One for Dan, one for the country.
And there has never been a more exciting time to be in Australia.
Dead, buried, cremated.
Australia's basically done for. We'll just end up being a third-rate economy. You know, a banana republic.
Just follow the money.
G'day, and welcome to the summer special season of Follow the Money. I'm Ebony Bennett, Deputy Director at the Australia Institute, and over the summer we're bringing you some of our best live sessions from Politics in the Pub earlier this year. One of the big goals of this podcast is to demystify the big economic issues in Australia and put them in plain English, because as you've heard on this podcast often, the use of econobabble has become entrenched in Australian politics and in the media. Our chief economist, Richard Dennis, argues in his book Econobabble that the use of this nonsensical economic jargon is designed to keep the general public in the dark. But the Australian Financial Review's chief political correspondent, Laura Tingle, argues that it also gives the politicians a security blanket. This episode was recorded at the launch of Richard's book Econobabble in Canberra.
Look, thank you, Ebony, and thank you, everyone, for coming. I'm very excited. This is the Canberra launch of Econobabble, and it's certainly nice to be here in front of a home crowd. And thank you, Laura, for launching this. Laura and I were in Perth on the weekend, so she's heard most of my jokes, but you haven't. So, Laura, you'll just have to play along.
Right.
But
thank you, Richard. Once upon a time, long ago, in yesteryear, as one of my colleagues always describes it, there was a time when economics, as opposed to the economy, didn't so dominate our political discussions. My sense is that it started with the oil shocks of the 1970s, the inflation that they generated, the disruption of the gold standard and all the palaver that went with it. This spawned a search for a new sense and for a new language of certainty. And the dismal scientists of the economics profession found themselves, as Paul Keating would say, smacked in the arse with a rainbow. There was Milton Friedman and monetarism. And various other economic theories that rose up to dominate the public policy, then political debates. There was Ronald Reagan's supply side and trickle-down economics. And right there were the first signs that the snake oil salesman had spotted an opportunity. The use of econobabble has been firmly entrenched ever since. In Australia, the Fraser government spouted monetarism, and even in the early years of the Hawke government, or should I say the Hawke-Keating government, when deregulation meant the government wasn't entirely sure how to work out what was happening to monetary policy, it tried to track the quantity of money in the system rather than its price. Richard argues in his book that the use of econobabble is used to keep us in the dark and ignorant. That happens. But I think it's also become something of a security blanket over time for our politicians, because it is not just the language that sounds complicated, it is the sort of confidence, the sense of science that it conveys. I often tell the story of the lobbyist who observed that during the Hawke-Keating period, there was no point walking through a door to argue a case unless you were armed with some economic modelling to back your case. He also observed that this switched in the Howard era when you had to come armed with polling to back your case. The most recent egregious and spectacular use of econobabble, as opposed to its everyday use, in our local discourse occurred just a couple of weeks ago when Malcolm Turnbull and Scott Morrison announced, well, sort of announced, that they would not be proceeding with the GST because of modelling. Of course, it wasn't really the modelling that was saying they shouldn't proceed, it was the inputs and the assumptions they put into the model and the question they asked it. But this sounds dangerously as if I'm veering into econobabble myself. The point here is that saying that modelling showed that a tax mix switch wouldn't produce a huge increase in efficiency gave their decision an air of scientific certainty, when in fact the bottom line was that they didn't think they could carry the politics of a tax mix switch or carry the states. It's not just econobabble that is a weapon of our political discourse. Richard and I, as he mentioned, were in Perth together over the weekend, and one of the panels we did was shared with Peter Doherty, who is a Nobel laureate, as many of you would know. I digress to say that he introduced himself and said, "I don't know why I'm on this panel, I don't know anything." To which I replied, "Peter, scientists obviously have a different concept of I don't know anything to journalists." Anyway, his book was about called Knowledge Wars, which I thoroughly recommend. And he was really arguing a very similar case in a way to what Richard's arguing in Econobabble, which is he's talking about the language of science and the methodology of science so that people aren't frightened of it and they understand what's happening. It's terrific, actually. So he's talking particularly about how it's used in climate change. But if you think about it, it's not just Econobabble, it's not just scientific babble. It's about, there's management jargon, which we all love in the public service in particular, and at Fairfax. And there's polling jargon. It all is about trying to make basic gut instinct decisions sound like science. The real point is that Econobabble is most regularly used for arguments about the size and role of government, masquerading as something else. And while politicians deploy it in their ideological battles, they can, as often, get trapped and enslaved by it themselves. Think of how Paul Keating got entrapped with his focus on the balance of payments, how he found himself in a position where he had to talk about the monthly movements in the balance of payments and why both interest rates and the budget were set to address it. The idea that you could target the balance of payments by interest rates and the budget balance became entrenched, and Keating and the rest of us became trapped by the tar baby. Almost every government since has been trapped by the budget surplus tar baby, and they don't seem to have been able to find a way to escape it yet. Often escape ultimately proves not to have been so difficult after all. Peter Costello solved the balance of payments trap by simply not having a press conference every month and by crystallising what had by then become a changed institutional structure that made the Reserve Bank's decisions on monetary policy explicit. The most important factor, however, was that you sometimes just need to have a change of personnel to someone who isn't stuck in the trap to achieve such a change. Since we've become so good at changing personnel in politics in recent times, the only real surprise is that our politicians don't sense the opportunity this presents for changing their dialogue. But this demonstrates the importance of understanding what lies beneath the Econobabble and the misuse of arguments that have arisen about economic policy. And that's a good reason to read Richard's book and why I'm happy to come along tonight and help officially launch it. Thank you.
Again, thank you, Laura. Much appreciated. One person early on, they said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Oh, I'm writing a book." I hadn't come up with a title yet, and they said, "Oh, books about economics. Love them better than sleeping pills." So there's my benchmark. Really, I just kind of want to do slightly better than that, or help you with your insomnia. So again, thanks, Laura. Thanks, the Australian Institute. Thanks, everyone. I'm an economist. I like economics. I'm often supposed to be embarrassed about being an economist. I'm often apologetic on behalf of my profession. But I actually think economics is important. I actually think it's a useful tool. But as I say at the start of the book, economics is like a tire lever. You can use it to change a tire or to beat someone over the head. It's up to us how we use these tools. And as Laura just described, in the last, I think, 15, maybe 20 years, politicians have started to use economics not to inform their own decision-making, not to educate the public about why they're making decisions, but to do the opposite. I think economics has become the perfect political cloak behind which decision-making can be concealed. Now, it doesn't have to be done that way. I'm arguing that that has become the role that people have used it for. So, should we spend more money addressing Indigenous disadvantage? Well, everyone agrees we should, but where would the money come from? Where would the money come from? How would you fund that? And today, we hear we need to spend enormous sums of new money building 12 submarines to replace the 6 we haven't used yet. But don't worry about the money, this is national security. Don't you understand? The question isn't how will we fund it, but how could we not? And that's fine, it's a democracy. We have to make decisions. We have to allocate scarce resources. Choices need to be made. But rather than using economics to highlight that to people, rather than using economics to design tools and policies that might be better or worse, and then float them in the democratic debate and say, well, here's one way we could fix it. What do you think? instead of helping to identify options, helping to identify trade-offs, and helping to identify policy options, economics is being used, I would suggest, as the central tool in saying there is no alternative. There is no alternative. If we don't cut taxes today, we will wind up like Greece, who has a 23% GST, by the way. hasn't saved them. So scary stories about economics are now used to say to people, there is no choice. And of course there's a choice. And as economists can argue amongst themselves over better and worse choice. And then in our democracy, of course other people are going to say, well, that's all very well and good, but you know, I want to do it differently anyway. That's fine. But to pretend that Australia, one of the richest countries in the world, living at the richest point in world history, doesn't have choices, is simply ridiculous. And ironically, after so many scare stories and so much econobabble, the politicians themselves now complain, I can't get the public to come with me on my reform journey. Because they bore the shit out of people. They can't bring themselves to identify a problem, admit there are options, admit there's no certainty, and ask people which of the hard choices they'd like to make. That's hard work. That's politics. That's bringing people with you. It takes time. It takes persuasive power. And instead, they just want to wave around an economic modelling report that says, if you don't do this, then we'll have a budget emergency. If we don't do this, we'll wind up like Greece. So I think it's not the only reason, I'm not suggesting that for a minute, but I think that the econobabble, which has been so effective at keeping people out of debates, has now actually so succeeded that it's destroyed the debate. Hasn't made the problems go away, it hasn't made the options go away, but it's actually completely undermined our capacity to have a sensible debate. So much so that Malcolm Turnbull in 5 months has moved from wanting to have a grown-up debate about economics to saying, if you vote for the Labour Party, you'll all be poor. Seriously. But that's where we're at. And of course, the people that have kind of had the scary stories thrown at them for so long just tune out. And they'd probably like to get a little bit engaged in a big choice, like who should they vote for? But instead, they're being asked to make a banal choice. You know, if we have a carbon tax, a leg of lamb will cost $100 and Whyalla will be wiped out. And if you vote for Labor, we'll all be poor. And if you vote for Kevin Rudd, then I think something about rainbows and spanking probably might come up. But we've got hard choices to make, and economics could play a partial role in helping us, but instead I'd suggest that it now plays a dominant role in silencing us. So just to very quickly touch on a few of the things I try and talk about in the book, again, really what I'm trying to say to people is you don't have to be an economist to demand that other people speak to you in plain English. Okay, if your doctor's giving you bad news and you don't understand it, I really hope you ask for a second opinion or that they explain it more clearly. If your accountant or your lawyer is telling you that you're about to go to jail and you don't know why, you might want to seek some clarification from them. Well, when politicians stand up and say because of the convergence between the nominal rate of GDP growth and the real rate of GDP growth, the elasticity of revenue to GDP is not what it used to be. And that was last Wednesday at the press club. I'm not kidding. Google convergence, nominal GDP, Morrison. Talk about the low point. In bringing the public with you in a debate, and I don't know if it's the low point or the high point for econobabble, but seriously, no one listening to that at home had any idea why he was talking about that, which of course was the point. Yeah. What he actually said in his 40-minute death by PowerPoint presentation was that there never was a budget emergency, that... And this is all in his speech. Right, I'm not verballing him. In 40 minutes, he said, There was never a budget emergency. I don't feel a need to talk about the budget deficit at all in this speech. We've cut $80 billion worth of wasteful Labor spending and had $70 billion in new spending of our own. So we've got choices to face, people, and we don't know what they are. But we do know that voting for Labor will make you poor. 40 minutes, complete nonsense, nothing. The idea that he was building the case for anything is remarkable. He was building the case for the abolition of PowerPoint at the press club.
The abolition of ScoMo.
So again, the purpose of writing the book was to say to anyone, you don't need to be an economist to say, that made no sense to me. Sorry, you want my vote, you talk to me like I understand. It's as simple as that. We as citizens just simply have to say, I won't be persuaded by anyone that can't persuade me. I won't trust anyone that can't be bothered to speak to me in a shared language. It would be unusual for two people that didn't speak Japanese to broker a conversation in Japanese. Yet non-economist politicians speak to non-economist citizens all the time through the medium of econobabble. It has to stop if we're actually going to solve any of the underlying problems. Thank you.
That's been episode 13 of Follow the Money, brought to you by the Australia Institute. A special thank you to Laura Tingle. Richard's book, Econobabble, is available now from redbackquarterly.com.au, or you can find it on Amazon and in all good bookshops. We've put links to Richard and Laura's Twitter handles in the podcast show notes, which is on our website at tai.org.au/podcasts. And here you'll find links to previous episodes of Follow the Money as well. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you enjoyed it, please share it with friends and leave a rating on iTunes because it helps other people to find us. If you live in Canberra or are visiting and want to see one of our Politics in the Pub events, please sign up to our mailing list on our website at tai.org.au. This episode was produced by Jennifer Macy. Jonathan McFeet from Pulse and Thrum composed our title track, and you can find more of his music at pulseandthrum.com. Please stay tuned. We've got more of the best Politics in the Pub sessions coming up over the next few weeks. Thanks for listening.